The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to do a special presentation today because I've had so many people call and email me, even stopping me on the street this morning when I was coming back from getting my juice, saying, what'd you think of the President's State of the Union Address, and do you agree or disagree? And so I thought about this, and I thought, let's bring on some guests who can address different parts of this, and that's what we're going to do. My first guest at the top of our show today is Professor Dennis Lowe. He is Professor of Sociology at California Polytech University in Pomona. He has degrees from Harvard University and University of California, and he's been active in water rights issues, government corruption, and globalization. And his articles have appeared on worldcan'twait.net, where he serves on the steering committee, and Counterpunch and Op-Ed News. He also has received important progressive awards for his writing, including Project Censored Award, The Nation Magazine's Most Valuable Campaign Award, and others. He has a book, Globalization and the Demolition of Society. Now, later in the program, we're going to be joined by Lewis Richman, because I wanted to focus on something I felt should have been discussed. What are we going to do to help or in some way assist the 90 million Americans who are over 47 and suffering from the largest number of diagnosed diseases in our history, and in fact on the planet per population? We have more obesity in adults than any other population on the planet for our size, and more dementia, Alzheimer's, depression, gastrointestinal conditions, diabetes in children. None of this is being discussed, and hence no solution. So I've asked Lewis Richman, who is a Zen priest and a meditation teacher and a lineage holder who was ordained by the renowned Japanese Zen master Shuro Suzuki, and we're going to talk about turning aging into a spiritual practice. I think you'll find it very inspiring, positive information, empowering. And then I'm going to open our phones for you to share your points of view and your comments. We're even going to play a little piece from our talking robots about our foreign policy. I think you'll find that interesting. So as you see, we have a lot to share, all of it in a constructive vein. And I also want to thank the people listening, all of you cab drivers out there. And right now, every time I get in a cab, you know, someone is talking about, you know, I heard this on your show. For all the cab drivers, and you pass on a lot of information, we appreciate you being there. And the school teachers, we have a lot of different groups. The carpenters, the Irish carpenter, Eddie Fitzgerald, who's a vegan and a great motivator to all the people around him who are learning how to shift their allegiance from a meat-based diet to a vegan diet. So we have a lot to talk about today, and we will. Let's begin by opening our discussion with Professor Dennis Lowe. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Actually, it's pronounced Lou.
Oh, Lou. L-O. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
One of the discussions that I was hoping the President would have spoken about was why we should reexamine globalization, and is he able, with all of his resources and his background, to distinguish how globalization works for one part of the population in the United States, certainly, and around the world, but how it works against the populations elsewhere. And I didn't hear that. I did hear that it will be more of the same, and this overarching idea of let's let business help guide us out of our crisis. And I'm asking, watching, is that the same business neoliberal globalization class that has prospered, but we end up not being so? Could you give us first your opening overview, take your time, on what you see as the fundamental flaws or the fundamental benefits in our current globalized model that we've been using in an aggressive way for about 40 years, and do you believe that that is sustainable? Not, and if so, what would be the message that you could share with the President of the United States?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Gary. As you mentioned, my new book is Globalization and the Demolition of Society, and the main thrust of the book, it covers a lot, but the main thrust that you just asked me about, what is the impact of neoliberal policies, which is really the political expression of globalization? Neoliberalism is the idea that free market fundamentalism should guide all things public and private. And I describe that movement, which, as you say, has been around for about 40 years, as the most dangerous movement in history, in the sense that it is the combination of extraordinary power and command over resources, and is shared by both major parties and most of the rest of the world at this point in their ruling parties, and also an extraordinary degree of hubris, arrogance, and indifference to the impact of their policies on the people and on the planet. The BP oil spill being one example of this, their failure to deal with global warming being another, the fact that the conditions that led to the economic crisis, the financial crisis of 2008, have not been addressed, and in fact, the conditions are even worse today than they were when things came to a head in 2008 and they had to be bailed out to an extraordinary degree, $16 trillion, in fact, was spent to bail them out. So, the thing about Obama's Sotu speech is that it's a classic example of the kind of thing that Obama has made himself famous for, positioning rhetorically. He establishes a position which he thinks is sort of middle ground and tries to appeal to both sides and says, well, this is not class warfare, this is fairness, and is making some suggestions about how we can bring jobs back to America and so on. But what he's not challenging, as you note in your introduction here, is the fundamental precepts of globalization, the idea that, business is going to take us out of these troubles when it is business itself and the drive for profits that have brought us to this disaster in the first place. So that's what I get into in my book, and there's a lot of dimensions to that. And a lot of different expressions of it. So maybe we can get into some of those particularities as you wish.
Sure. I'd like to offer an insight, and then I'd like for you to take off on that to see whether or not it applies to globalization. From 1945 until the mid-1970s, we had one of the greatest increases in the standard of living and the quality of life for middle-class Americans. That's where we really built our middle class. And at that time, people didn't make a lot of money, but they had disposable income, savings of about 13%. Most of the things they bought, they actually could afford because credit cards were non-existent at that time. And I remember even my own family, just a working-class, middle-class family. My father didn't make much money, but we had the basics. Then today, when I'm traveling around the United States, as I have been, I find that people who have educations, master's degrees, even engineers, are not able to make enough money to maintain a standard of living, to have any savings, and they have thousands of dollars in debt, and the student debt is not even able to be forgiven under bankruptcy laws that were written by the legislators who were influenced by the special interest group. So I ask a basic question. The major corporations in the United States are holding about $1.6 trillion in cash, high levels of liquidity, mainly from their profits. In the United States, another approximately $7 trillion or more is on offshore accounts, and yet Wall Street is saying, we will support your company, we will recommend your stock to institutional buys and pension buys if you continue to show that you meet these goals. Then Wall Street establishes the goal, and then they report and say, ah, stocks are down because they didn't meet their goal, or stocks go up because they exceeded it. And then I ask, well, there are three ways in a business that you can make a profit. First, you reduce your inventories. Well, that in the short term will make you a profit because it shrinks your cost of merchandise sold. Secondly, you can downsize your employees. You can draw back on their payroll and or their salaries, and you can let them go. Third, you can hold your brand intact and simply offshore all the job. Take the company, as 44,000 of the companies have been taken in the last 12 years, to another country. People are buying the brand. They don't care whether the jeans are made by slave labor. They're not looking at that. They're looking at, are they getting their brand jeans and at a price they can afford? So my question is, what would happen in our society today, based upon the principle that you're talking about, if corporations did an about-face, if they set aside a certain percentage of their profit, instead of going to the stockholders, to go to the employees? On the other hand, they also, in addition, they could also increase the wages so that people make at least a living wage. That's $20 an hour. And for an individual, that's just a living wage. It can be higher, of course, but not lower. And thirdly, that they stopped offshoring jobs and instead work within communities and said to Wall Street, we may have less profit to share with stockholders and our board of directors, but at least our workers have more money to spend within a community. Up to 67 times this dollar bill will exchange hands in this community because of how we're doing this, and we're creating less stress upon our workers. Do you believe that model would even be accepted today, or is the model that we don't care how you make your profit? Profit is the only thing we care about. If you got to offshore the jobs, do so. If you've got to cut their wages, do so. If you got to get a person who used to make $20 an hour, now making $8 an hour, do so. All we care about is the bottom line. Which do you think is more sustainable, and would they even be interested in this model?
You know, the other day in the New York Times, there was a piece about Apple Corporation that bears on the point you're just raising here. And it was talking about what Apple did, and in terms of especially its offshoring of jobs to places, particularly China, and why they have gone from employing Americans to mostly employing outside of the United States for their production, their manufacturing, and is an exemplar of what is happening overall to American industry. And at a conference that's cited in the article that Steve Jobs was in attendance, it was in Silicon Valley, and Obama was there, and he said something to Steve Jobs about, you know, can we bring jobs back to America? And Steve Jobs' answer was, these jobs aren't coming back. And so what we see going on here is a bottom-line logic, and it is a logical outcome, really, of the nature of capitalists. Capitalist economies are driven by desire for profit. They operate on that premise. They can only operate on that premise. And in fact, those people who say, let's go back to free market enterprise and break up these big, you know, giant conglomerates and allow the forces of the market to operate, what they don't recognize is, even if we were to do that, which is what the conditions were in Europe and the United States in the mid-1800s, within 50 years, those free market enterprises had become monopolistic, because the drive to make more money means the drive to eliminate your competition, which means get bigger and buy out or drive out your competitors. So it's a fundamental nature. This is one of the things I get into my book, that we're talking about system here. These are systems, and if you want to change the outcome of those systems, you have to understand the logic of the system. And changing the faces, changing the parties who are in power, without fundamentally altering the structure of the logic of the economic system, will reduce you to futility. You will not see what you want to see. So the changes that we see, you referred to the post-World War II period and the growth of the middle class in America. And it's contrast to what we see going on today. I mean, it's a long story, but to try to make this as brief as possible for the purposes of this interview, let me say this. One of the things that's a fundamental thing that's going on today is a fundamental breach in the historic social compact in America. And it's going on because of globalization and the ascension of neoliberal policies. The conditions that obtained in the post-World War II period are particular to that period, and they have to do with a number of factors, including the fact that the United States was the big winner in World War II, and that there was a division in the world between the socialist camp and the capitalist camp. And because of that division and that rivalry, within the capitalist world, they had to make concessions to people like the working class and oppressed minorities and so on, because if they didn't, then the socialist world would, you know, score major propaganda points and win over the non-aligned nations, which is why we had, as I talk about in my book, we had the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision. Just prior to that, the federal government said, and they were very explicit about this, they said, we cannot afford in our rivalry with the socialist world to have it known in the world that we are segregating some of our own population. So we have to change the way we're doing these things. When the socialist camp collapsed by the end of the 1980s, this meant that the capitalist world had no national rivals and could do what they pleased without that kind of opposition. So that's what we see happening, that they have just been cleaning up right and left. So to answer your question in the most direct way, would they be interested, would business be interested in the model you just described? The answer is no, they wouldn't be. And one of the things I think is interesting about Obama's speech last night is that that speech would not have been given in the way that it was given without the existence of the Occupy movement. The fact that he's talking about fairness here, and even this is showing up in the GOP race, you know, that they're talking about, you know, how you fired employees, you know, referring to Mitt Romney, for example, this kind of thing, and this whole issue of fairness. This is a, you know, the real action here is not in elections, which is one of the points I make in my book at great length. The real action is whether or not the political atmosphere can be changed, and that can be done through social movements. I heard you talking yesterday about the importance of people taking to the streets and affecting how people understand what's going on here. The game they're playing on us is Obama is the legitimizer of policies that were, you know, that Bush became famous for, and he's taken these even further, but he's rhetorically making it sound as if this is something other than what's really going on. So we see a very vicious, a mean new world, you know, with relentlessly undermining the conditions in which people live, undermining their living standards, making people subject to all kinds of intrusions and indefinite detention, you know, or even assassination if the government, if the president decides you're a terrorist, quote unquote, without any trial whatsoever or supervision. These are all these kinds of shifts in the stand towards civil liberties that you see, for example, in the National Defense Authorization Act, and these economic policies are all of one fabric. If you're undermining the living standards and the conditions and destabilizing people, which is more profitable for the big corporations to do, if you're doing that, then you have to create the more repressive means to control the rebellious sentiments of the people that are inevitably going to emerge. So this is the real situation that we face. And if people can come to grips with this, then we have a chance to change the atmosphere. But we have to understand what's going on and act accordingly.
I appreciate that insight. Would you follow up? I just have another two questions, and that's all. Would you follow up, please, with this? The FBI has been, for a number of years now, but accelerating, listing as terrorist any person that goes on to a piece of property to expose, photograph, or highlight animal cruelty. So for years, those of us who are vegans or those of us who have done films, myself included, on how animals are abused on factory farms. Now, they're listed now officially as terrorists. The FBI has been so deeming them that. Now, under this new law that Obama signed on New Year's Eve, based upon them being listed as terrorists, anything that the government agencies or the president chose to do to that person, they could now legally do. At the same time, we now have been told that virtually every protester, every demonstration has been are being photographed. We're also being told that street lights in cities are being replaced with not only a camera that you cannot see, but also audio to pick up on conversations, and these are being outsourced to private security firms associated with government agencies that are collecting data. And also, in addition to that, if anything on your computer, your cell phone triggers any one of, I think it's 1,800 words, that then means that they will do a closer inspection. They've captured your entire content and look to see if there's something that's dangerous there. Now I'm looking and thinking, gee whiz, who's asleep here? Why aren't we Americans saying, do we not have a right to protest peacefully? Do we not have a right to show our grievance? And if we now do so, and if that grievance is against Goldman Sachs or Bank of America or Monsanto, could then those corporations apply pressure through their lobbying activities or their connections to make whoever's protesting them or causing them some media problems or financial loss, could they not then be labeled as a terrorist and arrested? It's a hypothetical notion, but not when the FBI has made it gone from hypothetical to actual, and anyone showing up at any demonstration today could now be put into a position, yourself included, for even writing a book against globalization. You could end up on a watch list. Your thoughts, please.
Yes, it is hypothetical. It has, in fact, been enacted. Back in 2009, I wrote a story that went viral about the Department of Defense training all of its employees that protest was, quote, low-level terrorism, unquote. And so, you know, you look at these, there's many instances of this across the board. And when you put together this pattern, what you see is that we have the ascension of what is called public order policies, and this is something that actually began in Europe in the 1970s, and it has spread across the world since that time. Now, these incursions of civil liberties and this state surveillance over everything has been done under the rubric of the justification of 9/11, but in fact, it well predates 9/11 by decades. And public order policies are based on the idea that you can be not only kept under surveillance, but preemptively arrested and charged before you have actually done anything. It's like that film Minority Report with Tom Cruise,
yes,
where
you know.
And that is actually the reality today. It's not science fiction anymore. And it reflects, going back to what I was saying earlier, a shift in governance that is related to the shift in the economic operations of the societies that we live in, that they are treating everybody everyone is under suspicion, which means that, for instance, as I talk about in Chapter 4 in my book about the war on terror, they are collecting more data every single day, intelligence data, supposedly, that is four times the amount of data in the Library of Congress. I'll say that again. Every single day they're collecting four times the amount of data that is in the largest library in the world, the Library of Congress. So what are they doing with all this data? They're doing this data collection under the ostensible purposes of the war on terror, but when you collect that kind of information on everybody, including you and me, you're not collecting data that's going to help you prevent a terrorist incident. You're drowning in data. You're actually making yourself less able to detect actual terrorist plots. Why are they doing this? They're doing this because the governments and authorities have to keep track of and control and intimidate the domestic and foreign populations from responding appropriately to the repressive regimes and the exploitive plunder that is going on. They know that they cannot get away with this without being able to find the means to justify their repressing people, which is why they evicted, for instance, all the Occupy encampments. You know, because
all at once. All at once.
Yeah, relatively all at once. Within a couple of weeks, they just went after all of them.
But we later found out that was coordinated through Homeland Security.
Yes. Yes, it was. You know, and so they are very afraid of people speaking out. They're extremely afraid. The government and authorities, corporations, are very afraid of people stating truth about what's going on and expressing their grievances about, you know, what's going on, because they know this will catch fire. This is why that's so threatening to them, because they know that they are doing things to people, to the 99%, that the 99% or so are not going to continue to accept, you know, quietly. So as you're pulling the rug out from under the people, and you're sticking it to the people, you have to find the ways to try to instill fear and repress and intimidate people.
My last question for you.
Yes.
That ties in and actually segues to what you just said. Historically, the majority of individuals have relied upon the primary information outlets. Historically, that was newspapers, and then in came television and radio, and then a combination announced the internet. And it was way back in the beginning of the 19th century when J.P. Morgan was a very smart businessman, wanted to know, how do you influence people? And then his consultant said, well, you've got to have input in these newspapers. Well, which newspapers? Found out there were 25 newspapers that were the most read, most respected, that had the greatest influence on impacting people's opinion. And then he did something that today would be considered just completely normal. He put individuals that he had hired to work within those newspaper systems so that they had some control. Not all, but some control and influence over major issues. And in fact, his personal attorney ran that whole group. It ended up as the Council on Foreign Relations. Today, if you're a regular Democrat or a regular Republican, the Republicans will watch Fox News and listen to Michael Savage and Mark Levin and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham. The regular Democrat will listen to, you know, Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell. And I'm saying, please show me the difference between the traditional Republican today, or not the new Republican, the corporate Republican and the corporate Democrat, the media that they are a part of, the messages they're giving outside of blaming each other, but how they're dealing with any of these issues and informing us that our rights are under attack, informing us of how the corporations are using us as nothing more than commodities. You know, we are an income stream, pathologizing pregnancy, pathologizing children, pathologizing menopause, making up disease don't exist, and then not making the real issues important, and yet so many people still go to these too. How do you get people to say, wake up a second, your sources of inspiration, motivation, and guidance themselves are flawed in part, and therefore continue to rely upon them? You're just going to keep voting people back into office, keep people in power that are not going to fundamentally change anything. Your final thoughts, please.
Yes. Let me read you something, a short paragraph from the leaf of my book, Globalization and the Demolition of Society, which gets to what you're trying to talk about here. Does the advice we get on healthcare over the mainstream media give us enough scope, depth, and detail to allow us to treat ourselves and be our own physicians? Certainly not. Why would political advice dispensed via mainstream media and existing governmental institutions be any better? Is it reasonable to expect that reliance upon the major parties' campaign pitches and the injunction, just vote, could possibly be all you need to know to change society? The richest 497 individuals in the world have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the world's population. If you had such extreme wealth and power and enjoyed your luxuries more than justice, would you let your possessions be subject to the whims of the principle one person, one vote? Would you let your extraordinary wealth be outvoted? You would be crazy to do so. Unquote. And I put that on the cover leaf to my book as a way of explaining to people from the jump why I wrote this book. Because the content has to do with what's going on, but it's also about, well, what do you need to know to actually effectively address yourself to this and change this horrid picture that we see unfolding before our eyes. And in chapter 6 of my book, I talk specifically about the media that you're referring to and what has happened to the media and how I would say that at no time in American history have so many people been so poorly informed, despite the proliferation of media that we have, and despite the existence of the Internet.
Okay.
You know, I mean, these provide us some options, like your show, for people to hear more truth about what's actually going on. But the other part of this that's really important that I talk about in my book is, you know, what is your paradigm? How do you understand and interpret what's going on and why it's happening? Because one of the things that the people who are in charge accomplish to stay in charge is they provide the dominant paradigm by which people are used to understand what's happening and why it's happening. And if you're using a paradigm that does not really reflect what's going on, you will be blinded or misunderstand why things are happening the way that they are, and you will miss what's actually going on. So that's one of the purposes of it, to understand why this is happening and replace it with a model that will allow you to act effectively in addressing these terrible things.
A very important resource that you have provided, Globalization and the Demolition of Society. We look forward to another conversation with you. Thank you very much for being out there in the forefront of this major, both ideological and pragmatic battle that we the people, against such tyranny that exists today. We appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Gary. And just let me tell you, there's a website to accompany the book. It's DennisLou.com, and Lou is spelled L-O-O,
okay.
DennisLou.com.
All the best to you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Right. Professor Dennis Lou, professor of sociology, California Polytech University, and graduate degrees from Harvard University. I'm Gary Nall. Your turn in a moment to call in and share your points of view. We're going to go to our next guest in 10 minutes, talking about turning aging into a spiritual practice. Boy, could we use that in the United States. But joining me for a few comments on President Obama's State of the Union will be, and when we come back, will be our executive producer, Richard Gale. And Elizabeth, I know you're flooded with emails. Take just one.
Yes.
That represents most people's comments, and we'll do it right now, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back for Richard and then our guest.
Yes, okay, thank you. the majority of people are asking, loads of people are asking you, actually, if you had had the chance to provide, have a question-answer session with the president and talk on issues, what would you have talked about with him? What do you believe the president should have said that was not said about the important issues?
Okay, well, that's a good one, and that's a compilation question you're asking?
Yes, everybody's asking the same thing, basically.
All right. I do not fault the president for supporting the positions that are important to him. But here is what he did not cover that I believe represent the interest of the vast majority of Americans, that I would put in a different order. First and foremost, I would reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. And if he would have said, I'm reinstating Glass-Steagall Act, or I'm, these are things he has to propose and he has to work through the system, but if he became 100% behind it and rallied the American public, much like FDR used to have with his fireside chats, explain why you're doing something, get the public on your side, the Glass-Steagall Act reinstated, the Commodity Future Trading Act reinstated, banning trading in any commodity that's essential to life, so you could not have anyone profit from manipulating the land grabbing in Africa, which hedge funds and different governments are doing now. What do you do with the people that lived on that land? You have to displace them. How many? Several million. What do you do with the land once you have it? Well, you grow crops on it that you can then control the market for. So you can then artificially establish a price, which profits you, but what about the people who can't afford the product? They die from starvation. How many people die? Last year, 35 million people died in the world from starvation and resulting conditions. So if you establish no trading in water, then we don't have water wars. In food, then you don't have people artificially manipulating the price of food. Oil, then you don't have oil going up to $147 a gallon. Gas, same. So currencies, then you're not artificially creating imbalances that have happened in the past. And one of the people who made their fortune off that was George Soros. It's very interesting. He's a philosopher today, but ask him, does he have any moral leanings towards how he made his money? And on 60 Minutes, he said no. he made his money, made it legally. So too bad for those who ended up having to have their fortunes and couldn't afford a loaf of bread. Also, I would stop all trading in default swaps, credit default swaps, which is a form of insurance, which right now is over $600 trillion. That's, you heard me right. And derivatives. Because what happens is right now, why do you think Goldman Sachs and all the other major hedge funds and big Wall Street firms are investing in Europe? Because they know that our Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank will not allow them to fail. So they'll get their money out. But they also hedge their bet. They take an insurance out that they pay a small amount on. So if they end up, if let's say Greece defaults, they get paid 100% on their credit default swap, which could be trillions of dollars. There's not this money in the world. So they're playing with money that does not exist on gambling. And someone should say, lights on, this gambling game is over. That would be phenomenal. Stop the Federal Reserve. It's a criminal organization. Totally criminal. I would ask the president, can you name me who heads, who are the chief investors in the 12 Federal Reserve banks? Can you? Can you tell me? Remember, in the world today, the game is don't show you own something, but know that you control it. Take a look at how many corporations, insurance, and banks wealthy individuals and historical families own, but they know it would be bad if something went wrong, so they control an interest in the stock. Whoever controls the stock and positions on the board controls the direction of that. We don't even know who these people are, yet those are the real powerful people. They could buy and sell the Koch brothers and George Soros. That would be chump change to the people who have that much power, that you've never heard about them. So stop this. Disband the Federal Reserve. We don't need it. And give the Treasury 100% responsibility for creating the, actually printing the money, which it does not do now. The Fed does. And then don't allow another nickel. And you just heard my guest say $16 trillion. Don't allow another nickel to be given away to anyone. All right? Then do something really smart. Put a home foreclosure moratorium. No more homes will be foreclosed on. Do you know how many homes have been foreclosed on?
No.
10.4 million. Do you know how many more are going to be foreclosed on in the next 5 years?
No.
11 million.
God.
Four people per home. That's 44 million people. Was there a single comment last night about where 44 million existing homeless Americans are sleeping, couch surfing? Wouldn't that have been an interesting conversation?
Yeah.
For the 44 million Americans out there who have no home, who had a home, but we gave the money to the people who threw you out of your home, I'm going to talk about your needs. Talk with real Americans. Oh, I forgot. No one in Washington ever has to speak with a real American unless it's the very uncomfortable times when you got to kiss their baby, shake their hands, and act like you care about them. There is no caring. That's about as like you having a nosebleed and going for a swim in the Great Barrier Reef with 3,000 great white sharks.
My.
Let's see if you make it alive. So a moratorium. Then create a national food program to see that the 16 million hungry children have a meal, all the meals they need each day. Wouldn't you think that as a society we would care about our own starving children? That we have 16 million that are hungry, go to school, and don't have enough food. What does it say about our politicians when not a single politician, including the United States, who is nothing but a politician, even mentioned that we have 16 hungry children, 12 million severely malnourished? Not a word. Also, we have to de-ghettoize America. We have to do that by bypassing all profit corporations and going directly into the societies with nonprofits who work there so that they can recreate their society, meaning their communities, and rebuild them by giving tax credit to corporations that donate the money so they get a tax credit. The people in the communities get to tear down bad buildings, build community centers, build drug rehabilitation, build assisted living center, build gymnasium, build workshops, build social centers, build cultural centers, have community parks, all of which is entirely possible and wouldn't tax the American taxpayer dollar. Also, we should recreate a reforestation program, employing first the youth for trees and hedgerows and skilled labor for repairing bridges, levees, waterways, and gas mains. Right now, that will not happen, but in name it will. But giant contracts will go to a select number of individuals, but not to the actual reconstruction. Then forgive all student loans that were late and reduce all student interest to 1%. That would help a lot of students get out of debt. Then repeal all laws that prevent student loan holders from declaring bankruptcy. Then support senior citizens with free community hospital service and reinstigate a whole national program of community-based hospitals. Then allow offer small businesses zero interest loans for repayment after 2 years, but providing that for each $1 million they get in this loan, that they in turn have to hire one person at a living wage. So if you had $5 million for a small business in a local community, everything has to be made from that community using labor from that community, and you would suddenly be able to employ about anywhere from 5 to 10 million Americans, and you would rejuvenate and take our unemployment level down to less than 3%. Then close and decommission all nuclear plants, shift investment to support geothermal. We have thousands of geothermals in the United States, solar and energy wind. Ban all private funding of elections, every nickel out of all elections. Take corporate money out of politics completely. Demilitarize our forces around the world and close all military bases. Cease gas, hydro, fracking, and offshore drilling. Audit the Federal Reserve, audit the Defense Department, audit Homeland Security, audit the CIA, and reduce their budget to what is actually necessary to protect Americans, which would be an 80% reduction. Allow all corporations that cannot be maintained to go through structured bankruptcy. Never again protect a corporation because it's too big to fail. Eliminate the entire income tax system as we know it and create one system for all corporations that must pay a flat fee and cannot get out of it. Everyone else will be paying sales taxes or other taxes to their communities and states to keep them solvent. And then begin an independent audit of every bureaucracy in America. We have engorged, bloated bureaucracies that do not serve the public interest. Stop it. Stop the State Department from forcing other countries to use Monsanto's genetically engineered foods with the threats that they will be dealt with. Ban lobbying of state and federal offices. Create a national health prevention program under Medicare and include every school curriculum in America a program on disease prevention. Open tent cities that are built by the military in every state to have halfway house camps for returning veterans to meet with their families before they get back into society so they can be decommissioned from the terror of war and readapted into a more wholesome way of living. Acknowledge the danger of depleted uranium in all conflict zones where it's been used, and then get in there and tell the people your birth defects that are astronomical are due to depleted uranium and protect them. And disband the FDA, the USDA, the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, the National Institute of Aging, National Institute of Mental Health, National Institute of Allergy and Infections, and replace them with independent groups of scientists and public advocates that oversee the health of our nations and avoid all contact with special interest groups, no money, and test drugs and foods for their safety. Allow no money from any special interest group at any time into any federal agency. Those are just a few of the things that I believe would make a difference. Not any of those were touched on. Now, very briefly, we're going to go to our guests in just 2 minutes. We have Richard Gell that's going to talk about this. I just want to make two mentions. A, this Saturday, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Lafayette Grill and Bar, we'll be having a way, it's called Saturday Showcase and Saloon, to benefit WBAI. The entry fee is only $5, and that goes to BAI. I'll be there this Saturday to talk, to lecture, to meet people. There's going to be stand-up comedians and all kinds of entertainment and socializing. And the Lafayette Bar and Grill and Bar is 54 Franklin Street in downtown Manhattan. That's 3 blocks from Canal Street between Lafayette and Broadway. All trains to Canal Street or number one to Franklin Street. It's Lafayette Grill and Bar, 1 to 4 this Saturday. I'll be there. I look forward to other people because it's a good way to support the station. Richard Gale, your thoughts, please.
Hey, Gary. How are you? I want to encourage the listeners to do one little thing, and it's a very interesting little exercise because when you watch Obama That's one thing. But there's many distractions when in watching an individual who does have a particular charisma to him. Compared to then downloading, which is available all over the internet, you can download the transcript of his talk and just be able to review it. And when you read it in that way, it was a blur. I don't know who he was speaking to. Was he speaking to himself? Perhaps. Was he speaking to those individuals that voted for him in 2008 but are not really quite certain what they're going to do in 2012 and try to win their support? There was just so much that was left unsaid, and also just a spin. I want to give one example, because there was the promise of people being able to save $3,000 on their mortgage through a low interest, reduction of interest from like what's 6% now, and maybe reducing it to 4.5, $250 a month, giving you $3,000 a year. But this is what, in order to qualify for this, for Obama's program, this is what you have to have done. This would only be available for those homeowners who signed a mortgage before 2009, and they had previously refinanced under the Home Affordable Refinance Program. So those are the only ones that are going to be eligible for the scheme. You also have to have proved a good credit rating and must have been able to keep up with all your mortgage payments up until his new program. So what kind of numbers of people are we now being denied?
Tiny minority.
Right.
Tiny minority.
See,
it's smoke and mirrors.
It's a smoke and mirrors, and I think in reading the transcript and being able to disengage from the persona of Obama and to just really look at the words, people will come up to some very interesting realizations on the spin factor that was involved in this.
By the way, Elizabeth, I saw someone outside writing. Please post right after the show up on our website all of those. I was just told it was 30 suggestions I gave, so people can review those suggestions as meaningful ways of us going forward, those of us who are progressive. And by the way, there are 41% of us now, so we actually outnumber all Democrats registered and all Republicans registered combined. And we are going forward into the future. And there are a lot of millions and tens of millions of us. We just have to get organized and look at the facts. And as you said, Richard, look at it without any emotion, without any charisma. Just read what's on a page and see, does it make sense? And if so, to whom does it make sense? And that's where we're going to go with this. And again, this is a special program today. Thank you, Richard.
Okay. Thank you, Gary.
So on my website, all of the suggestions I just gave and more will be posted for you to examine as positive, empowering steps that we should be taking and demanding of all politicians. Okay? My guest is standing by. Lewis Lou Richman is a Zen priest, meditation teacher. He is the author of Work on a Spiritual Practice and A Whole Life's Work. Nice to have you with us today, Lewis.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Lewis, I'm very concerned that we have 90 million Americans who are over 47 and who are going to be facing life differently as they have in the past and are not really prepared for it. And we don't have the Buddha's first experience with witnessing three images, a person who was old and feeble, a person who was ill from disease, and then another that was a corpse, which led him on his search to find the truth and cause and effect and to change and the way to escape the suffering caused by change. So
keep in mind, in his day, those old and sick people were probably in their 30s.
Tell us what we should do if we are over the age of 40 and want to turn our aging process into a spiritual practice.
Well, that's the topic of my new book, which is titled, what you just said, Aging as a Spiritual Practice. And I begin by noting that this generation, our generation, I'm just soon to be 65, our generation of human beings will live longer on average than any generation in history. This is momentous. That's a good thing, but it also leads to the question, what are we going to do with all that time? And my thesis, my proposal, is both by predilection and necessity, we need to turn inward. There's inner work that I think our DNA has scripted us to do as we get older, to become more contemplative, to become quieter, and search for wholeness, for deep meaning, and also for a way that we can give back and contribute to the society using the wisdom of years that we have. I call this stage of life elderhood, and the whole book really is a kind of guidebook. The subtitle is A Contemplative Guide for Growing Older and Wiser. The whole book is a guidebook for how to go into this inner work, what it is.
Well, take us on that journey, if you would. Let's say someone can't buy your book, and then tell us the most important points that will guide us in that direction.
Well, I think the most important point, speaking as a Buddhist teacher, is that we do have an inner life, a rich inner life that I call spiritual in the widest sense of the word. Some people object to that. I define spiritual as paying close attention to the things that really matter. You can define that in traditional religious terms or in non-traditional terms. But I think the journey begins with the realization that, which is what I call lightning strikes, oh my gosh, I'm getting old, but more importantly, I'm not going to be here forever. My time is limited. What am I going to do? What's the most worthwhile use of my time? That's where the journey begins.
And give us some ideas what you have found have helped reposition a person to say goodbye to one passage in life and prepare them for the next passage.
Well, each chapter ends with a contemplative reflection, I call them. Some of them are traditional Buddhist meditations. Some of them are more inquiry exercises. But in each case, they are what I would call, what therapists call, reframing. That is, taking a situation that might be scary or depressing, like my body no longer works, I have a chronic illness, I just got a phone call and my college friend dropped dead while jogging, to take those unsavory aspects of aging and start to refashion them, reframe them. And one of the most important methods of reframing, and there's a lot both in the current science of aging as well as the ancient practices of Buddhism, is gratitude. Gratitude is right under the surface of our life all the time, and particularly as we get older, and it's easy to miss. So I have a number of gratitude practices that I teach and recommend in the book.
Give us an example of a couple gratitude practices.
Well, one that came to me as I was sitting quietly, as I often do, being a contemplative, is what I call the thank you prayer. And I've done this to any number of groups, and it's amazing what happens. The thank you prayer begins with the two words, thank you. And I say them in front of the group, thank you. And then I ask them to just tune in to their inner life, tune into their inner landscape, and watch the first thing or second thing that comes to mind. It's amazing what people come up with. People realize that the most mundane, trivial things, like that they're breathing, or that they can see, or that they just got a text from their teenage granddaughter, is an opportunity for such gratitude, and people really feel it. This feeling is been studied, actually, in aging research, and it adds years to your life. It lifts depression. It has a very wholesome effect on health and wellness, aside from the spiritual aspect of it. So that would be one example.
And one more example, please.
Of gratitude?
Yes.
Well, I have a practice I call the gratitude walk, which is really a contemplative walk in nature where the purpose of the walk is simply to note your surroundings with an attitude, I'm sorry for the unfortunate rhyme, with an attitude of gratitude. And again, you begin to see the most ordinary things, a tree leafing out in the spring, a squirrel gathering acorns, a dog walking along with its tail in the air. And your inner life responds to these things with a sense of appreciation and gratitude. Oh my gosh, I may be 66, I may have just had bad news from the doctor, but isn't life wonderful? Isn't it joyous to be alive? This is really the deepest message of the book, is to find joy in aging. I start the book with a story about my Buddhist teacher, Shunryu Suzuki, who was asked once, hey, Suzuki Roshi, which we called him that, why do we meditate? And he said to an audience of mostly 20-somethings at that time, we meditate to enjoy our old age. And it's taken me 40 years to realize how profound that really was. He wasn't joking at all. He was just saying it how it was for him.
Very important. Thank you very much for coming on and sharing just a few reminders that in the midst of all that we have to be concerned about, we should also never lose sight of the benefits we have of being alive and finding something to be appreciative from in everyday life. Thank you very much, Lewis Richmond. Lewis Richmond, my guest, and author of Aging is a Spiritual Practice. I'm Gary Knoll, and I want to take a few moments before we end our show to allow you a chance to call in and share your points of view on any of the issues we have discussed today. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Let me also mention that following our program today will be Mike Fader. And Mike has a very large and loyal audience, and Mike will be interviewing a person who will be doing a new show starting today at 7 p.m. Tomorrow, 7 p.m., called Occupy the Hood. So that will be an interesting discussion. So if we have anyone who would like to call in right now, I'm going to set a few moments aside so that you can share your points of view. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And then I go back upstairs, work with the editors on some documentaries we're doing. I'm writing a major treatise that I'll be publishing on the state of consciousness and where our consciousness is in America today and what we need to realign ourselves in our conscious in order to apply proper living principles to that. Also, this Sunday at 3 p.m., I'll be having a lecture, my only one in the near future because of my schedule, on It's My Life, So I'm Going to Live It My Way. And it's going to be a two-hour lecture. And I was going to do it last week, and there was a snowstorm that a lot of people couldn't come. So if you wish to come, last mention of this, call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And so that we're coming up to the last 2 minutes. I'll take one call if we can get one on real quick. And I also want to say hello to all the stations out there around the United States that carry our program every day, all day, in all kinds of areas. Texas and Wyoming and Montana. We're all over the place. And we don't have time to take calls, I'm told. So I want to thank you all. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow when we're back to our regular programs, health, nutrition, environmental issues, social issues, how to make it a better life, and then our guest. Stay tuned. Mike Fader, right now on Progressive Radio Network.